This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. It's been almost 25 years since the Beastie Boys released their album License to Ill for Def Jam Records, the company started by Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons. License to Ill became the first hip-hop album to reach number one on the pop chart. In the decades since, the group has earned critical acclaim for their albums, and in 2007 they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We'll listen back to an interview Terry did with the Beastie Boys, Adam Yauch, Adam Horovitz, and Michael Diamond in a moment. But first, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Hot Sauce Committee Part 2, the first Beastie Boys album since their 2007 all-instrumental collection, The Mix-Up. Hot Sauce's release was postponed a number of times as the trio dealt with the health problems of Adam Yauch, who'd been diagnosed with cancer. Yauch is now healthy enough to have completed this new album. Ken says it's fresh and vital by sounding old-fashioned and defiant.
The Beastie Boys are all about noise. Their beats are big and booming. Their production style is intentionally fuzzy, frequently distorted. Their lyrics are the dense, articulate yammerings of wise guys who will not get out of your face. As has been true since they began as a joyfully crude punk band more than 30 years ago, the Beastie Boys make virtues out of what, from most other people, would be annoyances. Listen to the groove they develop on Funky Donkey, which contains one of my favorite couplets on this album. I don't wear Crocs and I don't wear sandals. The pump don't work because the vandals took the handles.
Woo! Put this out of zip disc. Send it to your lawyer. File me on the funky. Like sipping lemonade and on no time. I'll be telling these parties like Dolly Parton.
Sometimes I get pad thai as a starter. My other order packs to you is much darker.
At Horovitz, I take a schmitz. I'm known for my glamour and my glitz.
Sandals, the pump don't work cause the vandals took the handles.
Stop singing that song in the wrong key. What you like it?
A funky donkey.
The theme of Hot Sauce Committee Part 2, in case you haven't guessed by now, is aging. Adam Ad-Rock Horovitz, Mike D. Diamond, and Adam MCA Yauch embody the phrase old school in a number of ways. And not just because Ad-Rock refers to himself as a grandpa who's been rapping since 83. The album has almost no use for hip-hop as it has evolved over the past decade, other than to ask a friend such as the rapper Nas to put in a cameo on one track. Indeed, the Beasties are pre-hardcore hip-hop. They're rappers. What's the distinction? Their interest, as was true of virtually all first-wave rap from the late 70s and early 80s, is in verbal content set to rhythms filched from R&B, soul, disco, and pop records. Their artistic alliances remain with rap performers such as Spoonie G and Grandmaster Flash, as well as with pop, punk, disco acts of an earlier era, such as the Heart of Glass era Debbie Harry. Here's a good example, the bass and drum heavy Lee Majors Come Again. It's a return to their punk rock roots with a driving tempo and a chorus that insists over and over that you, quote, take a look around you. One of the best songs on a generally superb album is Nonstop Disco Power Pack, whose opening I find touching even as the boys steamroll over the emotion. It begins with each member asking the other, "How you feelin'?" In context, it's an intro, a way to rev up. On another level, however, I can't help but think it's an implicit checking in with MCA about the state of his health after a battle with cancer. Either way, the vibrant life of the music, its disco power pack, to use the typically cartoonish Beastie phrase, is exhilarating.
Well, how you feeling, Adra?
Well, I'm feeling well, bona fide, qualified with the story to tell.
Well, how you feeling, Mikey?
Well, I feel all good, all day is how we play in the neighborhood.
Well, how you feeling, MCA?
Well, I feel right, I speak my words on the track, cause the track sounds tight.
Well, if you're feeling good and you're feeling right, somebody step up and grab a mic.
Yeah. Hello, everybody, and how you been?
It's Adra.
Grabbing on the microphone again. I got Grace, class, style, finesse, and debonair. Yeah. Don't care. The MC Whisper Bird kind of like a trainer. I take sucker rappers, I put them through a strainer. Like macaroni, cause they sound cheesy. Watch how it's done, boy, it looks easy.
On another track here, Long Burn the Fire, the Beastie Boys speak of an ideal rapper, quote, a soothsayer, not a player. The music on this album is deceptively offhand. It's a sustained piece of art collage with a unifying sensibility, anarchy expressed through technical discipline. As one fan wrote on a Beastie Boys comments board I read online, this stuff is vintage but new. Long burn their fire indeed.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Terry spoke to the Beastie Boys in 2006 when they released a concert film called Awesome, I Shot That. Adam Yauch directed the film using footage from cameras that were distributed to fans in the audience of one of their New York concerts.
Now, the movie was shot in Madison Square Garden. The first time you performed there, you opened for Madonna. Now, I understand on that tour, her fans booed you just about in every performance.
Oh, they did a lot more than that.
What did they do?
Some audience members were crying, actually. Yeah, it was touching, but actually
I remember getting yelled at by a parent because we were cursing, and they were like, how could you do that when I'm here with my
child,
young child?
What was it like relatively early in your career to be booed so frequently on somebody else's tour?
We got up for it, really.
You get kind of like into pro wrestler mode where you kind of get into it for a while. It's kind of funny.
Come on! That's where the whole King of the Paramount came
from. Yeah, we got into a mode for a while where we'd come out and they wouldn't boo, and then we'd try and do things to get them to boo, like they would be applauding, and we'd just say, you know, it's really hard to get up here, and you should...
We need to be appreciated by you people.
What's it like now to sing things that you wrote, 20, 25 years ago, when you were much younger? You've changed a lot over the years. Do the lyrics still fit you?
It's a little awkward at times. It's a bit awkward.
Some of them are dumb, but yeah, it's just fun, Sometimes it's fun to just play the old songs anyway, no matter how stupid they are.
Have you revised any lyrics that you're no longer comfortable with? Lyrics from
Yeah, I know I do personally. Some of the stuff that I say on License to Ill, I say some real dumb stuff, and so... I like the song, and the song's important to, people that like us or listen to us, and so it's important. So, if that's what people want, we should, why not play the songs? But there's some things that I don't like to say.
Can you give us an example of something you've changed?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but just some dumb things about, like, I don't even know.
Usually the more sexist ones are the ones you switch up.
I do have one that I'm particularly proud of, and I'm not sure even who it came from, but in No Sleep to Brooklyn, I say, and Yauch's in the back at the Mahjong board.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure what is the original.
I don't even know if we could say it on the air.
Yeah, I don't even know if we could. But I just particularly like that because it kind of really reflects where we're at now.
Your first hit was Fight for Your Right. And Adam Yauch, in the liner notes of A Best Of Collection, you write that the song began as a goof and that it started as a satire of I Wanna Rock kind of songs. So what did you have in mind when you wrote that?
Yeah, basically that. I think you summed it up. It was just kind of like just one of those like smoking in the boys' room type things. Just thought it was kind of funny, but I don't think we realized that it was going to be the sort of the main focus of the album. That it was going to, like, I think the way we were looking at it, we were just kind of making this dumb song that had sit somewhere on the album. But I think that CBS and Rick and all the saw it as being able to be something much larger than what we imagined, and they kind of made it the main focus of the album.
Let me play the record, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And this is the Beastie Boys, Fight for Your Right.
Kick it!
Okay, so this is like your first big single, a really big hit. And you're saying it started out kind of as a goof. So did your fans misunderstand who you were?
I think maybe we just ended up with a different bunch of fans than we expected. Like, I think if we could have picked at the time, like if I could have known like how much that record would have, that song would have informed everyone about the album, to use Mike's word, informed. My choice would have been more to pick like a different song to be the main single, like Hold It Now or Slow and Low or Posse in Effect or one of the other cuts. But anyway, that song was the one that informed everyone. And so next thing you knew, we would go out and play shows and look, and the whole place would just be full of like frat boys, like drunken frat boys. And so it was, so there we were.
You know, and we were talking earlier about going from punk to hip-hop, so I don't imagine you had a big, you know, frat boy audience for your band when you were playing punk.
We definitely did when we were punk, and then also when we were playing hip-hop, like what we came out of by hooking up with Russell, we got like a really good education in terms of going on tour and opening up for Run DMC. Like, we were on a tour opening for Run DMC, Houdini, mm-hmm. LL Cool J. So that was like a completely hip-hop audience. So to then all of a sudden go into this world of like kind of like, I don't know, I guess a more pop audience and like kind of college kids wanting to party and drink beer and go see a Beastie Boys show, that was completely foreign to us and beyond anything we ever imagined.
Adam, in those liner notes you write, by drinking so much beer and acting like sexist macho jerks, we actually became just that. So did you feel like...
I never said that.
did you feel like you were becoming the image that you created?
I think so, yeah. I think in a way, you know, it's almost like we started out kind of like goofing on it, but then just sort of became it in a way.
It's the become what you hate syndrome. Yeah. So you
set out with an agenda of parody, and then a certain amount of time goes by and you kind of cross that line.
Yeah, like you parody something enough. You
it's
know?
Kind of like when you go to England and you do a British accent the whole time, and then you come home and you have a fake British accent.
So was there a point where
you know what I mean?
Yeah, was there a point where no? was there a point where you said to yourselves, "We crossed the line. We've become our own parody."
Definitely, but I don't. I think that point almost came like we had to kind of get off of tour and almost have a second away from that to sort of assess and realize, look where everything was at.
And so, what changed when you had that realization?
We switched to weed.
Yep.
Yeah. And then we made Paul's Boutique,
which was very different from which I think some fans loved and some fans felt disappointed because it was a departure. What was different about it?
Well, weed is a good word. It weeded out some fans too, and that was okay.
And found some fans that were weeded out.
Yeah, and the fans that got that moved on to U2 or Skritti Politti or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think like with Paul's Boutique, you had two things going on. You had like people who probably expected like Fight for Your Right to Party Part 2, and they were very disappointed and were like, "This isn't what I want at all."
And they got weeded out.
And they got weeded out, and then there were the fans that were like, wow, this is whatever. This is something I'm really into. And they got weeded out,
too.
They
got weeded out.
They got in a different meaning of the word.
You each come from families with pretty interesting artistic backgrounds. So if we could go around and if you could each talk a little bit about how, if at all, your parents' kind of artistic inclinations affected you when you were coming of age and developing your own artistic sensibility. Adam Horovitz, let's start with you. I mean, your father's a pretty well-known playwright, Israel Horovitz.
Yeah. I grew up, my dad, every time I was with my dad, he was always, not always, but he wrote. He's a writer, so he was always in his office writing. He made a plan, like a point of, this is my work. I'm going to do this every day for these amount of hours. So I think that's where I got like a work sort of ethic. That's why we work so many hours we spend in the studio, and it just seems kind of natural because just watching my dad, how many hours he just spends in his office just writing and writing. Even when he doesn't have any particular story he's writing, you know what I mean? He'll just go in and just, these are the hours he's got to do it. So, you know, it was definitely influential to me just in terms of like a work ethic, just create whatever. You know, whatever you do, create something. And that was kind of the impression I got. And definitely from my mom was a very, very artistic person. And that's I got creativity from my mother.
Michael Diamond, your parents were in interior design. Do I have that right?
Well, my dad was actually involved with the art world. He was an art dealer.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know. For me, I'd just say my influences, I had two things. One was I was the biggest thing for me, I was the youngest of three brothers. Mm-hmm. So growing up here in Manhattan in New York City at the time that we grew up, like in the 70s and the 80s, it was such an influential time of so much music happening, so much, you know, just kind of like everywhere. And it's, you know, this is a time before the internet. You know, you really had to have local access to things. And it was just like you had hip-hop, you had reggae, you had punk rock. I don't know what my entrance to all this kind of music would have been if I wasn't the youngest of three kids, because it was kind of like whatever my oldest brothers were going through, I wanted to do the same thing at the same time. So even though I was like 12 or 13, whatever they were doing when they were 16, I had to be involved with it.
So what were they listening to that you loved?
I mean, whatever, that transition. I mean, that went from like stealing my brother's, you know, Steve Miller, Fly Like an Eagle album to then like discovering Elvis Costello through him to then, you know, getting turned on to hip hop from my friends or stealing, you know, one of my brother's Bob Marley records. Yeah, I don't know. And then for my parents, I'm trying to think. I think like the biggest influence I got from my parents was just being exposed all the time to, like, they were really good about, especially since we grew up here in Manhattan, it wasn't like they would go to events and we'd stay at home. It's like all the time we'd be going to art type
galas?
Functions. We'd be going to gala. No, I don't know. Gala events. I think the kids got left at home for gala events.
Right. I'd leave the kids at home for
but,
gala.
But, you know, if you're going to like an opening or, you know, all the time, they were like, you'd have like whatever creative people kind of coming in and out. And I think like I learned as much from the kind of creative people around the periphery of like my parents as I did from going to school in a lot of ways.
Adam Yauch, your father's an architect. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but he's actually more of a painter. He went to art school for painting for a long time, and then he switched over to architecture, and he did that for a while, and now he's gone back to painting, and I think he's...
Google him.
What influence has that had on you?
Well, you know, I went to college for a couple of years, and I remember, like, I was mostly signing up for, like, music classes and, like, art classes and all kinds of things, and I remember my mom kind of being like, what are you doing? Like, if you're going to go to school, you got to take some more academics. This is ridiculous. And my dad just kind of said to me, like, do whatever you want. If you want to take art classes, just take art classes.
Wow.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Did you ever expect that the Beastie Boys would be together for 25 years?
No. We didn't know. I mean, it's not like we had no idea it was going to be for 25 days.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, when we started the band, maybe I'm speaking for myself here. There was no, like, big ambition. It was kind of like, you know, that was a time when we were going to see bands all the time. A lot of our friends were in bands, so it just seemed like the natural thing, like, okay, let's start a band and have fun. You know, we were in...
Play a couple of gigs or whatever.
Yeah, we were in high school. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to take over the world and do this for our whole lifetimes. I mean, I do think, I'd say about last 3 to 5 years, my mom has finally realized that I'm not going to get a day job.
Yeah. You know, I think if we knew that the band was going to be around for this long, we probably would have thought of a better name.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. How did you think of the name?
I had nothing to do with this. Just Adam Horvitz.
It just seemed like it was a funny idea at the time. It was literally like we thought we were probably just going to play a handful of gigs. You know, we all our friends were in bands. Everybody was in bands. We just like used to throw together a band and like write a couple songs, play a couple shows, and you're done. You know.
I mean, also part of the fun of being in a band was coming up with the stupidest name you could think of.
Like my band New Wave Old Hat. That's a big one.
Angry Samoans is a good name.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having us.
Okay. Thank you.
The Beastie Boys recorded in 2006. Their new album, Hot Sauce Committee Part 2, was released earlier this week. The extended video for the first single, Make Some Noise, was directed by Adam Yauch. Also known as Fight for Your Right Revisited, the video features Will Ferrell, Jack Black, John C. Reilly, Seth Rogen, and others playing the Beastie Boys young and old. You can find a link to the video on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Mel Gibson's behavior has made him something of a pariah in Hollywood. But Jodie Foster, who co-starred with him in the 1994 film Maverick, cast him in the starring role of her new movie, The Beaver. Gibson plays a depressed man who talks to others only through a hand puppet. Foster plays his wife in addition to directing the film. David Edelstein has this review.
Every single person to whom I've mentioned The Beaver has announced that he or she has no intention of seeing another movie starring Mel Gibson, even if he's playing a nut job like they think he is in life. But I couldn't wait. I think Gibson is a fascinating actor, and he was especially good playing crazy in the 1997 thriller Conspiracy Theory, a welcome change from the usual Make Mel Mad template, where he's driven to take vengeance on those who kill or kidnap his wife or lover or child or dog. In The Beaver, Gibson plays Walter Black, a near catatonically despondent business owner who finds a beaver puppet in a dumpster and begins to talk through it using a blunt Cockney accent. Although Walter plainly manipulates the puppet and makes no ventriloquist-like attempt to conceal the movement of his own lips, the beaver claims to be alive and speaking on Walter's behalf. To engage Walter, you must literally talk to the hand. Walter even gives a letter of introduction to Meredith, his stricken wife, played by director Jodie Foster.
Hello? The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet. Walter, what the hell is this?
Read the card.
Yes, I...
Read the card. Read the card.
The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet designed to help create a psychological distance between himself and the negative aspects of his personality. Please treat him as you normally would, but address yourself to the puppet. Thank you.
There you go.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet. Right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
Despite its bizarre trappings, Kyle Killen's script for The Beaver is rather tidy. It's a problem drama on the theme of defense mechanisms. Walter, through The Beaver, explains that instead of living in misery, he has wiped the slate clean and become someone else. In contrast, the movie presents his high school son, Porter, played by Anton Yelchin, who seeks to confront his own demons, most of them having to do with his father, and purge them in a way more conventionally psychotherapeutic. He's also made it his mission to force the girl he has a crush on, played by Jennifer Lawrence, to acknowledge the death of her older brother instead of repressing it. That doesn't prove to be the fastest way to a girl's heart, but neither, at the other extreme, is his father's planting a kiss on his wife's lips with a hand puppet. It's too bad that the beaver itself isn't much to look at, being an ordinary hand puppet with anatomically correct small eyes. Worse, what comes out of its mouth, or Walter's, isn't especially witty. You never see how Walter in the short term could be liberated by giving in to his aggressive and confident side, how he could actually have fun being madcap and filthy-minded. Gibson bites his lower lip as if chagrined and makes his face into a blank so that you register only his wounded blue eyes and sagging features. He abstracts himself. My guess is that Jodie Foster was so afraid of trivializing Walter's mental illness that she forgot she was an artist and not a social worker. Her pacing is so glum that the movie could have been directed by her character, Walter's troubled wife, a Meredith Black film. In the later scenes, Gibson begins to rebel against the Beaver, which starts making like the demonic ventriloquist dummy in the old Anthony Hopkins thriller Magic. But even their grisly final confrontation doesn't liven the movie up much. I swear, the biggest laugh is when Walter makes the rounds of talk shows and ends up on Fresh Air opposite Terry Gross. I won't spoiler joke. I guess to hear it, you might have to be one of those people who goes to a Mel Gibson movie.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Playwright, screenwriter, novelist, and director Arthur Lorentz died yesterday at his home in Manhattan. He was 93. Lorentz wrote the books for the landmark musicals Gypsy and West Side Story, and he wrote the novel and screenplay for the Hollywood hit The Way We Were, starring Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. Lorentz grew up in Brooklyn. He wrote plays and screenplays in the 40s, but his career was interrupted when he was blacklisted for several years because he'd worked for civil rights causes and joined a Marxist study group. Lorentz collaborated with Leonard Bernstein and a young Stephen Sondheim on West Side Story, which opened up on Broadway in 1957. Soon after, he worked with Sondheim and Julie Stein on Gypsy, which starred Ethel Merman as Rose. Here's one of the big numbers from the original cast recording.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people of 105, but I at least gotta try. When I think of all the sights that I gotta see, yet all the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be, yet come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's peachy for some people, for some humdrum people to be. But some people ain't me.
Terry spoke to Arthur Lorentz in 1990 as he was directing a revival of Gypsy, starring Tyne Daly as Rose. Lorentz felt this new production could include elements from the book that were left out of the original production, as they were considered a little too dark for Broadway.
The production was really rather sweet. It laid off a lot of things that, it being 1989, I was able to do. It's very different from the other productions. It goes much more deeply into the relationships, into what I would call the dark side of it.
What's an example of something that was too unpleasant for the original production that you could go into now?
Well, it still is. I mean, Mother is still sacrosanct in America. And they don't like, a lot of people don't like seeing this woman who is not the most pleasant mother in the world. But also there is this relationship between Rose and Herbie the agent is extremely sexual now. It has elements of romance, but it's distinctly a man-woman relationship. That was never played before.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the original production, Ethel Merman starred as Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from what I've read about the original production, you weren't really satisfied with her performance.
You didn't read that anyplace.
Well, what I read was that you referred to her as an opening night performer, someone who gave her all on opening night.
Yes, she gave her all, but...
After that, it kind of diminished a little bit.
That's true. I'm very grateful to Merman because I don't think they would have done the show without her,
mm-hmm.
even though she was on the skids, as it were, at that time. She had a flop or two, and as a matter of fact, the show opened with almost no advance. And if we hadn't gotten good reviews, David Merritt, the producer, told me we'd play 6 weeks and that was it. She did us a great service, and for that time, she was terrific. but it was never what I felt the performance should be.
Well, I read that one night you had a talk with her in front of the whole cast about her performance, about her not giving her all. What did you say to her?
I don't know where you read that.
I think it was in Sondheim and Company.
Well, it's only semi-true.
Mm-hmm.
What it was, I don't think she wasn't really an actress. She didn't know she had taken to walking through the show. But what I called her on was that she and Jack Klugman, who was played opposite her, the show had been running 6 months, and they were breaking up on stage, telling each other jokes, which I think is insulting to an audience. The audience comes, make them laugh, not each other. And I called her on that.
What was her reaction?
Oh, it was as though she were a naughty little child who'd been spanked. She took it.
Mm-hmm.
And went right on doing it again.
Now, you directed the 1973 London production of Gypsy with Angela Lansbury.
Right.
And I just know this production through the cast recording, which I think is wonderful. Tell me about casting Angela Lansbury in the part and directing her in the role of Rose.
That, again, was totally different. She's a very fine actress, and they wanted to do the show in London. It had never been played in London because when it originally opened, Merman was going to do it in London, and then some agent unwisely convinced her, and she unwisely said it, let herself be convinced, that she was so terrific that she should go on a concert tour of the United States. So she refused to do it in London. They would have no substitutes, and her concert tour did not do well, which is the understatement of this interview. So it had never been done in London. They wanted to see it. And the producers wanted Angie. I knew her. I'd worked with her before. And we did it in London. And again, it was different from this production because the emphasis was more on the comedic quality. She's a really terrific comedian, Angela. And Rose was quite a reach for her. There's a kind of earthiness, if you will, trashiness about Rose that's very difficult for Angela to get. But in her own terms, she was terrific. There was no relationship between her, again, and the agent.
There are wonderful songs in Gypsy. Now, I've heard Stephen Sondheim, who wrote the lyrics for Gypsy, say that he sometimes likes to incorporate lines from the script right into a song so that the lyric is really speaking the mind of the librettist, the person who wrote the book. Did that happen in Gypsy?
It happened a lot. Steve is wonderful to collaborate with, and he thinks I am, because I say, go ahead, raid the dialogue. For example, the first line of Mr. Goldstone, have a Negro Mr. Goldstone, was taken from the dialogue. But he means really more than that. He is one of the too few lyricists who knows that each character speaks differently and sings differently. They have a different diction. So he waits, or he waited in the case of Gypsy, for example, till I would write the characters. He would see how they would speak. That affected what lyrics he wrote for them. Their language is different.
Do you ever feel that the librettist gets the least credit in a musical? You know, in a musical, you always hear so much more sometimes about the songwriters.
Every librettist feels that, and it's accurate. No musical is ever referred to as the work of the librettist. It is only referred to in terms of the composer and, if the lyricist is as famous as Steve Sondheim, the lyricist. I think that goes back to opera, where you don't know who wrote the libretto for the operas.
Mm-hmm.
You only know the composer. And I think one of the reasons we don't have more and better playwrights writing musicals is that everybody has a need for recognition, which is, by the way, what Gypsy is really about. And it is so frustrating not to get any recognition for what one has done in creating a musical that a lot of playwrights simply won't try. And you get the people write letters to the Times and the critics say, oh, yes. And then for 2 minutes they recognize the librettist and then they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply a given. The reason I do it is I just love musical theater and I love writing them. I'm stuck.
When you're writing the book for a musical, do you have a sense in your mind of where the songs belong and what the transition into the song is going to be like?
Total. That's the way I write. I plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
I do as much as possible to write into the music. Let the music take over. Lift the characters to the point where they can't do anything else but sing.
Can you give us an example?
Yes. At the end of the first act of Gypsy, there's a song called Everything's Coming Up Roses, which if you haven't seen the show, you think is a kind of happy, jazzy Broadway tune. What happens with that song is one of the reasons why I don't want it, and we all don't want it to be made into a movie again. What is done with that song you can only do on the stage. You can't do it in the movies because movies are too literal. What happens is a woman literally goes off her rocker and bursts into that song. This is a woman who suddenly has an enormous disappointment. She's furious. She's angry. She rages. And she rages until she can't anymore, and it comes out musically. It's against the emotion. It's all this ridiculous, insane optimism that this woman has. And it's done in music.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we listen to Everything's Coming Up Roses? Angela Lansbury is singing. This is from the London production that you directed in 1973.
And just remember that listening to her
mm-hmm.
are her daughter and her lover, and they are terrified and stunned by this woman's madness.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now, honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks, clear the tracks, you've got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow, honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning, stand the world on its ear, set it spinning, that will be just the beginning, cutting up like the light.
Angela Lansbury from the London production of Gypsy. Before we get back to their conversation, let's hear the Jet Song from the original Broadway production of West Side Story.
When you're a jet, you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected, you're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet. Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out. Let's get cracking.
Where are you gonna find Bernardo? At the dance tonight at the gym.
But the gym's neutral territory.
Ooh, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-O.
So everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony and me at 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're jets!
The greatest!
When you're a jet, you're the top cat in town. You're the gold medal kid with the heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swinging.
Let me ask you about the book that you wrote for West Side Story. Now, I believe the idea for a musical based on Romeo and Juliet was the choreographer Jerome Robbins.
That's right.
Well, how did he originally pitch it to you? What was the initial idea he proposed?
The initial idea was quite different from what it was. It was about a Jewish girl and a Catholic boy in New York over Easter and Passover. And I thought that was AB's Irish Rose, and I wanted no part of it. And then several years passed, and I happened to be in California, and Lenny Bernstein was in California. By that time, juvenile delinquent gangs had come into being. And on the coast, there was a great problem with Chicanos, which in New York was Puerto Ricans. That's where the idea came from, the front page. And that's what the... And then Lenny and I called Jerry and said, we're ready to go.
Did you have any reservations about singing and dancing gangs?
On the stage, no. In the movie, yes.
Mm-hmm.
On the stage, the stage is total illusion. You come into a box, and you see this proscenium, and then people hop on and hop off. There's an orchestra in the pit. But people have imagination, and the theater makes you use it. And you will accept almost anything. But movies, to me, are either... The nature of the medium is such that movies are either realistic, by that I mean naturalistic, or surrealistic. To me, in the movie A West Side Story, I know it was a great hit, but when those boys came tour-jeteing down the street, I didn't believe it for a minute. I still don't.
Now, you didn't write the screenplay for either Gypsy or West Side Story. Did you want to?
I wasn't asked to write the screenplay for West Side Story, and I wanted to. I was asked to write the screenplay for Gypsy, and I was going to till they told me they cast Rosalind Russell, and the director was Mervyn LeRoy, and I bowed out. We had wanted Judy Garland. They didn't because they said she had a weight problem. But, of course, with the passage of time, Gypsy covers 15 years, even if she had a weight problem. If her weight went up and down, it wouldn't have mattered.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the movie?
Of Gypsy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a candidate for one of the worst movies I ever saw.
So, you know,
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The only good thing in the movie was Natalie Wood.
Uh-huh.
R.I.P.
Well, just give me a sense of what you hate about the film.
Well, Rosalind Russell was very busy being Rosalind Russell. Again, she was wonderful in Wonderful Town. She's wonderful when she played this, what they used to call a dame. This hard-driving, executive, smart-cracking, certainly middle-class, if not upper-middle-class, woman. This is nothing from this blousy, vulgar, common, trashy Rose. I mean, she wore chic clothes. I remember her black and white high heels in the train station. It was just all off.
Mm-hmm.
A number of weeks to check up on them and as... In the immortal words of George Kaufman, remove the improvements.
You've written for movies and for the stage. Mm-hmm. What are some of the primary differences between writing for the two forms?
The other day, there was a movie I was considering writing. Oliver Stone was going to produce it, and he called me up and said, why don't you want to do it? I said, because the day I finish the script, I'm out on my ass. I wrote my first movie in, I think, 1948. This is now 1990. There's a lot of talk, but essentially, the attitude has not changed. The writer is low man on the totem pole. Would they woo you and they'll pursue you? He's the least paid, comparatively, of the actors and the directors. And the great god in Hollywood, as in this country, is money. That determines respect. And once they have the script, as it says in Gypsy, so long, Rose, don't slam the door as you leave. You're out. And they do. Not only do they cast and play it as they want, they rewrite it as they want.
Now, one of your screenplays, The Way We Were, which you also wrote a novel of the same name, there's blacklisting in that, you know, in Hollywood. Were you ever blacklisted yourself?
Absolutely, in The Witch Hunt. Mm-hmm. And there's an example of what they do. The climactic scene in that story, in that movie, was shot and neatly cut out.
What was the scene?
The scene was where the Barbara Streisand character says to the Robert Redford character, he says to her, the studio says I have a subversive wife, and they will fire me unless you go and become an informer. And he wants her to inform, to save his butt. And she says, well, there's a very simple solution. Willy-nilly circumstances force you into this. I will get a divorce. You won't have a subversive wife. What they kept was willy-nilly circumstances forced you into a solution. I will get a divorce. The whole business about informing and subversion, which was what the picture was basically about, they cut out. They said the public doesn't want it. They want a romance. How did they know? I don't know. Maybe they looked in a crystal ball. But it's so unsatisfying. The picture was a great success. But what I wanted to say in that picture, what the picture was about, gets thrown out with the garbage. So it's not very interesting, exciting, fulfilling. I could go on with the words for me to work in movies. The theater with all its handicaps is exciting and a bigger challenge, and you can do more and you have more fun.
Thank you so much, Arthur Lawrence, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arthur Lawrence speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Lawrence died yesterday at the age of 93. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.